Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, the pitfalls of archiving old films.
Even if you dunk a reel of burning nitrate in a vat of water, it will continue to burn. So obviously for archives, nitrate film is a very, very major headache.
Leo Entiknap joins us to discuss how we stop the chemical rot to preserve the billions of feet of old film footage currently sitting in vaults around the world. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and welcome to the December 2011 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast. Also along this month are Phil Broadwith, Phil Robinson, and, in spite of his inappropriate moniker, Andrew Turley. They'll be talking about bonds in benzene, shrinkage inks, remember those, and how to turn urine into a stream of electricity.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And to kick us off, you've heard of four-wheel drive cars, but four-wheel drive molecules? Phil.
Well, Chris, this is a four-wheel drive vehicle, but it's not your average Range Rover. It's much, much smaller. We're talking about a nanoscale car. It's a single molecule, and each wheel is powered by a little bit of electricity that will propel it across a metal surface.
Even smaller than a Mini Cooper. So how's it work, and who's done it?
OK, Chris, well, this is some work from Ben Feringa's group in Groningen in the Netherlands, and they've been working for several years to make molecules that turn independently, so whether they're powered by light or various other ways. But what he's done now is take several of those motors and show that you can actually couple them together and get them to work in harmony, which is a significantly more difficult problem.
What did they have to do in order to achieve that? What were the big challenges they had to overcome?
Well, first of all, you've got to actually have the right kind of motors or wheels, if you like, and synthetically fix them together. You've got to actually design a molecule that will hold these wheels in the right kind of orientation. That's not particularly easy, and even now they had to do it by making them from mixtures of forwards and backwards rotating wheels, trying to get a molecule where you've got two wheels that both rotate in the same direction, and then fixing that onto another molecule that has two more wheels. So there's a fairly large error rate. You end up with ones that will either spin around or just won't move anywhere. But a good portion of them have the wheels, four wheels, oriented in the same direction so that they all turn and propel the nano car across the surface.
How do they push it along? What makes those wheels turn? What's the energy source?
That's another big thing in this kind of area. People have kind of made cars before that you could drag around using a microscope tip or push around in different ways. But what this does is that it's actually self-propelling. You give a tiny impulse of electricity from a scanning tunneling microscope tip. The tip doesn't actually touch the molecule, it just gives it a little bit of electricity, and that stimulates the rotors to rotate, which propels the car along.
Where do they say this needs to go next? Because obviously they've solved some problems, they must have encountered others. What are they working towards with being able to do this?
The eventual idea is to have a kind of nanoscale construction site where you have various building blocks and little vehicles that can pick those up, take them to different areas and put them down, put them together, build up structures at the molecular level from the bottom up.
And speaking of building things up, how do they address each of the individual chemical groups to the right place to make all of those functional components?
The molecule, it is a single molecule rather than an assembled group. So you would use chemical synthesis techniques to join the molecules together in the same way that chemists would build up a drug molecule or a whatever else. You start with a certain set of building blocks. The difference was just joining them together to make a functioning vehicle.
So there's hope for larder yet then. Yeah. Andrew, talking of things that go round, I think it was Kekulé who envisaged, or in a dream, he saw some snakes that were swallowing the tail of the snake in front, going round in a sort of spiral. That was the concept of the benzene ring. And these guys have taken it a step further.
In a sense, they've taken it a step back, actually. The defining feature of benzene is this delocalized system, which is electrons spread evenly across six carbon atoms, arranged in a hexagonal.
Which is why we draw that little nice circle in the middle to indicate that there are no defined bonds in there. It's a delocalised cloud of electrons all shared out.
Absolutely, and that's a very stable conformation. It's a very stable structure. And what Inga Ulusoy and Matthias Nest at the Technical University in Munich have done is turn off that that delocalization, in a sense, relocalize it by giving it a massive boost of energy.
Oh, well, so you can actually make the carbon atoms have double bonds in some places and not in others.
You can, absolutely. Very,
not very stably, though, surely.
No, but it's that instability that makes this useful, because the idea is hopefully at some point you'll then use this to do reactions with this molecule that wouldn't normally happen because the delocalized system is so stable.
So you were just saying they give it a burst of energy, what, heat or something?
So they zap it with a laser, so that's light in effect.
And what does that do to it?
So that boosts it up to a higher energy state. The reason this is so stable as a delocalized system is because it's in its happiest state. It's very hard to then boost it out of that state. You give it a lot of energy and it goes into something that it's not as happy in, that it's more unstable in, which is these relocalized bonds. And it will only stay there while it's got all that energy. It very quickly loses that energy and falls back to its ground state.
I see. So you could then use that sort of more active, unstable state and react something with it while it is in that form to get interesting products.
Hopefully. That's the idea. I mean, this is very much the start. At the moment, what's great about this research is that you can, to some extent, validate things that are predicted by theory. There's an awful lot of work done on trying to predict what these energy states would be and what they would look like. And it's nice to see them to some extent in reality.
So they can actually see double bonds forming in the benzene ring in discrete places.
Yes, it's not a perfect system insofar as it's done so quickly that the bond lengths are all equal as they would be in the delocalized system. But yes, you can see that the electrons have relocated themselves between alternating carbon bonds.
Why has no one spotted this before? It doesn't seem like rocket science to fire a lot of energy into a benzene ring and make it do something different. Surprising.
You have to overcome certain symmetry rules. It's quite complicated maths. You have to energize it in one way and then energize it again in other directions. It's important to note that it looks very elegant and looks very simple because it's a simple, very, very symmetrical structure. All of this stuff relies on symmetry, and it's very, very elegant when there's a lot of symmetry involved. As soon as you put a functional group on that hexagonal structure, you break a lot of the symmetry, and then things won't work quite as neatly.
Andrew Turley. The motion picture industry was born in the late 1800s, but digital didn't come along until relatively recently, meaning that most of the archive footage that the world holds is on film. But how much of it is there, and is this a blessing or a curse?
My name is Leo Entiknap. I'm a lecturer in cinema at the University of Leeds, and my research focuses on the preservation and restoration of archival film, video and audio.
So conservatively speaking, Leo, how much film is there archived around the world, and how far back in time does it go?
I can give you a figure in this country. The British Film Institute, for example, holds, roughly speaking, 300,000 cans of master material, with each can containing between 1,000 and 2,000 feet. So we're talking hundreds of millions worldwide, possibly even billions worldwide.
What actually is that film? In other words, chemically speaking, what's its composition?
Illusion of Continuous Movement takes between 10 and 16, 17 images per second, depending on the human brain and reflex system, in order to kind of create that illusion, if you like. But in order to do that mechanically, a medium needed to be invented that was both flexible, so it could be bent and shaped as it passed through the recording and projecting mechanism, and it needed to be transparent. The eureka moment, if you like, was when George Eastman in the United States discovered nitrocellulose. It was thin, it could be molded and shaped to pass through the components of a film transport mechanism, and it was transparent. So in projection, you could shine a light through it in order to create a projected image on the screen.
It so, also had a number of other slightly less attractive chemical attributes, didn't it?
The downside for anybody who's seen Cinema Paradiso will know is that the stuff is highly, highly inflammable. It's actually quite difficult to ignite. It needs to be exposed to, you know, a very intense heat for several seconds. You know, the odd spark won't do it. But once it is ignited, it burns very, very fiercely. It gives off very, very toxic gases while it's burning. And crucially, the chemical reaction while it burns generates its own oxygen. So you cannot extinguish a nitrate fire by any way other than reducing the temperature below the point at which combustion occurs, which is virtually impossible. Even if you dunk a reel of burning nitrate in a vat of water, it will continue to burn. So obviously for archives, nitrate film is a very, very major headache. The upside is that we now know that if you store nitrate film in a combination of very low temperature and a very low humidity environment, it will last for a very, very long time, and it is very, very chemically stable. So assuming you can give it those atmospheric storage conditions, which is not an easy or a cheap undertaking at all, it is a very, very reliable and very, very stable long-term storage medium. So the chemical attributes of nitrocellulose, if you like, are both a blessing and a curse at the same time.
So what are people like you doing about trying to archive this footage? Because if we have all these thousands and thousands of feet of film, many of them extremely valuable, we're never going to get that capture again. How can we actually preserve this material, apart from in this very expensive way that you've suggested?
For a long time, it was believed that the chemical decomposition of cellulose nitrate has basically to do with the breakdown of long-chain molecules and cellulose esters. We know that basically the warmer and the wetter the environment is in, the faster that reaction takes place. The film archive community took the view that the only way to save the content that had originally been recorded on this stuff was to copy it onto what they thought was a more stable film base. Because of the fire risk, in the late 1940s, early 1950s, the film industry abandoned the use of cellulose nitrate as a base and started using cellulose triacetate instead. And in 1948, the first cellulose triacetate safety films went on the market. The good news with acetate film is that it doesn't have the intense combustibility characteristics that nitrate does. It's no more or no less flammable than paper is, really. The bad news was that when this stuff first came in, the film industry and the archive community believed that it was immune to the decomposition problem as well. And in fact, over time, we discovered that it was not. And it was really the research that took place in New York and Manchester during the 1980s, which made the discovery that atmospherically controlled storage was the way to go in a very cool and dry environment. The stuff has a shelf life of centuries. The principle that most archives tend to use now is one of so-called passive conservation, the idea that you have the master film copy in cold and dry storage. From there, we can make the access copies that we need to actually see the film, and we can go back to our preservation master more or less whenever we need to.
Because there are really two aspects to this, aren't there? There's one, actually preserving the original material, which has archaeological and factual and other kinds of interest value in it. And then there is the content that it actually contains, the material that you would actually see put on the screen. And so on the one hand, we want to get the data off as fast as we can to make sure we don't lose anything, because we can digitally render that and then just proliferate that onward in various ways into the future. And then we could worry about how we actually keep the original material in its pristine condition for as long as possible secondarily.
Yes, exactly. In film archivist language, if you like, what you're talking about is the difference between preservation and access. The basic principle is that the original camera negative, so the strip of film that actually passed through the camera that shot it and from which all other copies are made, obviously that's the highest quality element of that film. And if it survives, that's the one you want to preserve. But of course, often it doesn't survive.
So you really want to get this onto digital as soon as possible, because then it's lossless.
Well, theoretically, the issue with digital is that basically it is a superb medium for access, but it's a lousy material for preservation. The reason why is that we can put a nitrate or an acetate reel of film on a shelf in a cold and dry vault, and it will remain more or less chemically stable for certainly decades and probably centuries. With digital, however, the bottom line is that nobody has invented an offline digital carrier that enables you to do that. There is quite simply no digital data storage technology out there at the moment that will enable you to record your ones and zeros, put them on a medium, be that a hard disk or a magnetic tape or an optical disk or whatever, on a shelf, come back in 100 years' time with any confidence that you're going to be able to play it. The only reliable way we have of preserving what we call born digital content long term is by, to use the jargon, continual format migration, which basically means accepting that you're going to have to copy this stuff every so many years and planning and budgeting to do that, which makes a commitment to the long-term preservation of born digital content far more difficult and far more expensive than preserving film is.
And who would have thought it? That was Leo Entiknap from Leeds University. And equally, who would have thought, Phil, that we'd end up talking about this too?
Well, Shrinky Dinks, as you are aware, and many people will be, Chris, are a popular children's toy. The bits of plastic, and when you heat them up, they shrink.
Great. They're sort of thermoset, aren't they? So
yeah,
basically
precisely.
They're stretched when they're big, and when you put them in the oven, the molecules slip past each other, they get small again.
Exactly, exactly. So you stretch them out, they're in an energetically unfavourable position, if you like, in that form. When you put some heat in, they relax, and they go back to their natural state, or a preferred state, and as a result, the overall material shrinks. So some scientists in America, Michael Dickey and his team at North Carolina State University, they've used this property to get the Shrinky Dinks to fold into defined shapes and three-dimensional structures.
That's very clever.
It is. As I said, when you heat up Shrinky Dinks, they shrink. What these chaps have done is they've localised where that shrinking occurs by patterning hinges onto the strips of Shrinky Dinks using nothing more complicated than ink from a desktop printer.
Ah, so the ink acts as a focal point for the absorption of energy from the heat source.
That's
presumably
right.
Injecting more energy there in an asymmetric way, so you get a force.
You're quite right, you're quite right. It relies upon heating of these things to the Shrinky Dinks to cause them to shrink. So if you localise that heating by patterning it with some ink, in this case, those areas receive more of the heat, they relax quicker, and so you develop a hinge at that point, which causes the material to fold. If you put those hinges in the correct places, you can put together a box, for example, or a nice pyramid.
They can actually make practical structures with this, then? It's not just for fun?
It's not just for fun, no. I mean, and the area of pre-programming shapes is quite a big one. The advantage here is that it's so simple to do. They mention in their paper that there are lots of ways of doing this, but it requires some quite complicated processes, whereas in this case you have an existing polymer that you can go and buy in any children's store with some ink, again, readily available, and you can easily put these things together.
Are there any practical sides to this? Could this be used industrially or pharmacologically, that kind of thing?
Well, they do list a number of potential applications for this process. So they have robotic actuators, for example. They also mention drug delivery devices or other biological devices. There's a wide range of potential applications, but from my point of view, it's really just good fun.
Thanks, Phil. Were you a Shrinky Dink man, Andrew?
I've never heard of Shrinky Dinks, I'm afraid.
You've missed out.
Well, they sound wonderful.
You didn't own an anorak and did have a life, perhaps. Tell us about the origin of life, on the subject of life.
Okay, so this is all about chirality. There's a phenomenon in all biological systems whereby molecules that are chiral all have the same mirror image structure. Now, chirality is fundamental to chemistry, or large areas of chemistry in any case, and it's a phenomenon of when you have two mirror images of the same molecule.
Like hands, basically.
Hands are a great
right
example.
Right hands and left hands. They're both hands, but one is a right-handed variety, one is left-handed.
Absolutely. So they've got all the same constituent parts arranged in the same way, but all opposing each other in that conformation.
What is the view on the fact that if I look at the amino acids in use in my body, they're almost exclusively left-handed? Some microorganisms cheat and they use a few right-handed ones in order to get round the fact that we chiefly use left-handed ones. All the sugars, on the other hand, are D-forms, right-handed. What do we think is the reason for that, and how did it come about?
Okay, so there's a huge amount of interest in trying to work out how that system was established. Obviously, once established, it makes sense that these molecules may always wish to use the same and perpetuate that same system. But how did that initially come about? There are ways of which this can be done in the lab, but the tricky thing is trying to work out how in the real world that may have happened. And what these researchers, who are Cristobal Viedma and colleagues at Universidad Complutense in Madrid, have found out is that you can enrich a system with one of those mirror images, which are called enantiomers, by using boiling. Simply boiling this stuff up. Now, they've started with inorganic molecules, so they've started with sodium chloride crystals, and eventually they would want to look at organic molecules. By boiling it up, you set up a temperature gradient. So it's this supersaturated solution is creating crystals in one place and dissolving them in another region, and that enables the system to go from a 50-50 split, which you would expect of left and right, to preferentially going to either more left or more right.
But I'm going to ask the killer question, which is why? Because I don't get that. You've got a heat source. Why does it sort them out?
So it's needed to create continual process of crystallization. These are supersaturated solutions, so they contain solid as well as liquid at the same time. And once you have created a nucleation site, at that point, it will choose between one or the other, and it will stay with that one mirror image. So what you've created is a continuous process by which you've already got some of the seed material, and it stays with that system.
And then how do they extrapolate that into, okay, this is the early Earth, now we're going to preferentially go for one-handedness or the other?
Well, it's not at that stage. What these researchers are concerned with is showing natural systems that could generate an excess of one of the enantiomers over the other.
Because just by chance?
Just by chance, yes.
Hasn't worked for me on the lottery yet, though. Thank you, Andrew. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, the fuel cell that runs on urine, and evidence that early modern humans, had they been around today, would almost certainly have been frequenting a Harry Ramsden's fish bar. But first, green clothes. Now, that's the green from an environmental standpoint rather than the colour that they've been dyed.
OK, my name is Martin Bide. I'm a professor in the Department of Textiles, Fashion, Merchandising and Design here at the University of Rhode Island in Rhode Island, USA. I'm always amazed to consider that there are about 70 million tons of textile stuff produced around the world every year. In terms of how much people spend, it occupies quite a large chunk of any economy. And all those textiles have to be cleaned, dyed, printed, finished, and so on, which takes a lot of chemistry to do. And some of the things that we're doing are not very environmentally friendly. So there's been a long battle over the last 20, 30 years at least to re-examine the things we do with textiles to find greener alternatives.
How realizable is that goal? Laudable as it is it feasible?
I think it very much depends on how you define the goal. We will not accept clothes that are not colored. We like our things not to wrinkle. And there are always trade-offs. If you want to avoid the chemicals that make your shirt wrinkle-free, how much extra energy you use to use an iron to take away the wrinkles. Some of the major problems are just the sheer volume of stuff that we use. Not only is the population increasing and therefore using more textile items, but we like to go shopping and buy clothes. And the amount that every person is using keeps climbing per year.
So what are the big chemical challenges that we've got to overcome if we're going to do this in a more sustainable and, I suppose, greener way?
I think the challenges are regulatory and governmental and common sense attitudes than they are chemical. For example, I can go back to wrinkle-free clothes. We have a very, very good and very cheap way to do that. It involves releasing very small amounts of formaldehyde. For many people, formaldehyde is a chemical of concern. So for many years, we've looked at alternative non-formaldehyde ways to make wrinkle-free clothes. And those technologies exist. They are slightly less effective. They're somewhat more expensive. So I think it would take a demand from either a government or a consumer to say, I insist that there be no formaldehyde in my clothes, which would tip the chemistry into a greener mode.
Where are most of those clothes actually manufactured?
The vast majority of cutting and sewing happens in third world countries, and I'm not sure if China counts as one of those, but China is obviously one of the big ones. And it tends to follow that if the cutting and sewing is being done somewhere, that it makes sense to have the textile mills doing the dyeing and finishing somewhere close by. So increasingly, this is a problem that exists outside Europe and outside the United States, where it is difficult to use greener chemistry.
We're looking at the chemistry for a minute. What sorts of alternatives are there? And are they actually superior to the current more nefarious or nastier chemicals that are being used? In other words, is there an incentive to try to use greener chemicals apart from an environmental point of view?
That's difficult because there's such a vast array of textile chemicals. In contrast to many other things that we buy, the real cost of textiles has gone down over the last 20 or 30 years. You know, we constantly strive for the cheap T-shirt, and it's a very, very price-competitive business. So anything that would work and allow something to be produced more cheaply, I think it's going to be seized on pretty quickly. I think the hard work comes when you say that there's a good alternative that might be slightly more expensive. It would take some work to get that introduced.
What are the present goals then? What area of the textile industry is probably the worst offender, and where should we be putting our efforts to try and get redress?
I think denim has a lot to answer for. The indigo dyeing process is one that's fairly inefficient. I think if someone came along today and said, hey, I've invented this new dye called indigo, there's no way that could succeed in the marketplace. But because we're used to the way it works, we use it a lot. And then paradoxically, we wash it off. So with all these denim washing plants, I think because they tend to be small scale, they work on garments rather than miles of fabric, that's a big opportunity for a cleanup.
I suppose one of the other interesting areas is that it's very easy to immediately start thinking about all kinds of chemicals and ignore the blatant chemical right in front of us, water. Because when I was in Australia, I remember being quite gobsmacked when I was discussing with someone who was actually doing calculations to look at the embodied water in the majority of household objects. And he said, just the carpets in your house use as much water as if you took the whole house and filled it up with water three times over, which in a water-strapped country, that's a lot of water. Yeah. And I suppose that we also need to consider the more mundane, everyday chemicals like water when taking into account the environmental equations and impacts of these kind of industries.
Yes, textiles is a heavy water user. People are careful about the condition they throw it away. It may not be drinkable water that leaves a textile plant, but I think increasingly it's rare for truly nasty stuff to be in that water. Most textile mills now have to do some kind of primary treatment before they dispose of it, and that's been true for a couple of decades. A lofty goal would be a textile mill that could just recycle its own water and, you know, prove to the world that it can clean it up to a point where it's safe to use in a dyeing process, which demands fairly clean water.
So it's either back to nature and we all wear grass skirts, or we're going to have to clean up our act.
I think so, yeah. We'll keep wearing clothes. Some of the interesting stuff that happens, I think, happens in the choice of fibers we use. You know, we either grow cotton or we use oil to make polyester. It's an interesting environmental argument about which is friendlier. It's conceivably a lot easier to recycle polyester back into polyester. Cotton is a difficult thing to recycle back into a good garment. It usually gets downcycled or, you know, into paper or something like that. So I think if you take the oil out of the ground and make it into polyester and then recycle, that's a fairly green thing to do.
There'll be knitting grandmas jumping for joy everywhere. That was Martin Bide.
Now, where there's muck, there's brass, they say. And the same turns out to be true for urine and electricity. Phil.
If you've ever wondered what happens to your urine, then this could be the piece of research for you.
Well, normally it goes down the loo.
Well, yes, Chris, but there are modern designs of toilet that can separate solids from liquids. And what Yanis Iropoulos and John Greenman at the University of the West of England are doing is wondering whether we could use that as a fuel source.
Oh, right. Which? The solid phase or the liquid?
This would be
phase?
The liquid. So we're talking about the organic molecules that are in urine. So there's uric acid and various other things. Interestingly, not the urea, which is the main component, but we can come back to that in a minute.
So what are they doing and how does it work?
Okay, so what they've done is take a microbial fuel cell. So that's a fuel cell that has a layer of bacteria inside it, and that's the bit that chews up the molecules and supplies the electricity as part of those bacteria's metabolism of the molecules.
So the bugs scavenge these complex organic molecules that are in the urine, and in the process of metabolizing it, they yield some kind of electrical gradient.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, they're the same kind of bacteria that are used at wastewater treatment plants to do the same job, but they're set up in such a way that they give electricity as well as just kind of growing the bacteria.
So they tap off the electricity. What about yield? I mean, how much do you actually get?
Okay, well, what the team found is that if you make the fuel cells smaller, they're more energy dense, so you can get more efficient conversion. So they make tiny little fuel cells, and each one can run for 3 days at a current of 25 milliamps. From 25 mils of urine. But the idea would be you'd have stacks of many hundreds or thousands of these to convert the kinds of amounts of urine that you might get from, say, a gents' public toilet where it's already separated, or if you could have separating toilets and that kind of thing.
So the pee goes in, power comes out. What's the waste, or what's rejected from the system? What's left over?
Well, the other things that are in urine are nitrogen in the form of urea and also phosphates and potassium. And these are all very useful nutrients. They're also very difficult to get out of urine and expensive. And that's because you don't want to release those back into the environment. They cause algal blooms. They cause all sorts of problems. We could also do with them for fertilizer. And that's the other good thing about these fuel cells. If you set the fuel cell up in the right way, then the bacteria like to grow, they need that nitrogen, phosphate and potassium to do that growth.
Ah, so as the bugs expand their numbers, then you'll shed some bugs from the cell and those can be grabbed and they will have bioincorporated these other materials, which you can then recycle out. The bugs have extracted them for you.
Exactly. You do actually need to put a little bit more carbon in, so the organic molecules that are present in the urine itself are not quite enough to balance it up so that you can take all of the nitrogen and phosphorus out. But if you add something cheap like acetate, you can not only generate electricity, you can also generate a kind of ready-made fertilizer in the form of biomass from the bacteria.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, from pissing to pisciculture, perhaps. Phil, tell us about this fish story.
So this story is all about looking at old pots and what was in them and what that tells us about what people were eating around at that time. And much more generally, it's a really nice example of a bit of archaeological chemistry. So Oliver Craig, who works at the University of York, has been looking at some 6,000-year-old pots to see what sort of food people around that time were eating.
So these would be pots that people were using to store food or prepare food, and the food would have imparted some kind of chemical signature to the surface of the pot that we can read even today.
Exactly, exactly. Even millennia later, these traces still exist, and so we can look at these, and that gives us some clue about the lifestyle of
those.
So
what were
people.
The chemicals they're looking at?
The interesting chemicals that they found are fatty acids, alkyl phenyl fatty acids, which indicated that the people at that time were eating fish. These are marine-derived molecules, and that was also indicated by an isotopic analysis. So they were looking at the types of carbon present here. There are three types of naturally occurring carbon atom, and one of those, carbon-13, is also an indicator of a marine or aquatic source of the things that were being put in there.
But I'm sure, Phil, that I've read things in the past about people analysing pottery, including stuff even that may be submerged on the seabed for a long time, and looking at the molecules that are embedded in that ceramic in order to work out what people were cooking, storing, eating and drinking in these vessels.
Yes, and you're quite right, Chris. The interesting bit here, or the new part, is what exactly they have found. This idea that people were storing or cooking in these containers fish, basically. That's what it tells us. So this relates to the idea that around about 4000 BC, when these time when these pots are from, is when farming began to spread throughout human communities. And there's, of course, that caused huge change in the way that that humans were living at that time. And there's some arguments that that caused humans to abandon some of their previous ways of collecting food and hunting. This evidence would suggest that, in fact, they continued to fish long after the appearance of farming, and that the farmers did not give up fishing, as you might naturally expect, in fact.
We're talking of giving up. Don't give up on the euro yet, is the message we're all being told. Tell us about this month's trivia, which I think is terrific.
Well, there's been a lot of talk recently about the Eurozone and the crisis that it's in. But what you might not know is that your euro actually contains europium.
The rare earth?
The rare earth metal, europium. That's quite right. If you hold a euro note under some UV light, you will find that it phosphoresces in the distinctive red of europium.
Because europium is used in TV screens to create the red colour you watch, isn't it?
That's quite right.
Why is europium in there, though? I mean, is this a sign that actually some of these bureaucrats in Brussels do actually have a sense of humour then?
Obviously, it's an anti-counterfeiting measure, so the reasons behind it are somewhat secret, but it is certainly true that they do contain europium, and it's nice to think that it's because someone had a bit of a smile and a wink somewhere in Brussels.
But will the currency devalue to the extent that the europium in the notes is worth more than the notes are themselves? If that happens, then Brussels really will see red. That's it for this month. Thank you to our interview guests, Leo Entignap and Martin Bide, and our contributors this month, Phil Broadwith, Phil Robinson and Andrew Turley. The production was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. We wish you a very wonderful Christmas, and we'll see you in 2012.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.